So Prabhupada was saying, why don't you look back at your own ancient culture? But they were saying, no, we want to see MTV, and they were much more interested in things like that. Of course, MTV, that's anachronistic, wasn't there yet. But they wanted everything Western. So Prabhupada came up with a strategy. He said, well, if I can go to the West, and if I can establish this Vedic culture, this Bhagavad Dharma, if I can establish this in the West, then people in India will take it seriously, because they just want what's from the West. So he did that. He went to America, and he had great success, and of course established a worldwide movement. Then in 1970, when the movement had grown so much all over the world, and people were chanting Harinam all over the world, Prabhupada thought, now the time has come to go back to India. And so he gathered up some of his selected disciples from around the world, and had this triumphant return to India, and it really took India by storm. And Giriraj Swami was the first wave of devotees, of bhaktas, that went back to India. And by far he was one of the most successful. He Prabhupada had him stay in Bombay, and his job was to go around to many of the leading citizens in Bombay and persuade them to join us, to help us. And he did that. He did attract and persuade many of the leading citizens of Bombay. He had tremendous success, and he's done valuable service around the world, not only in India, where he stayed for many decades, but South Africa and many other countries. So he lives up in Carpinteria, which is just going up the coast just before Santa Barbara. And has just published a book of his memories of Prabhupada and the time he spent with Prabhupada. So, very happy he's here, my old friend and brother, Giriraj. So, this is a sort of a pre-Janmashtami celebration, or early bird.
Now you should introduce yourself. I would do it, but I'm not as intelligent or eloquent as you are. I think only you could do justice to it.
To myself, right? I'll just say a few words about myself, so... and hopefully we'll finish before midnight. So, I'll give you the short. There was an old, very funny movie back in the 70s called Airplane. There was that movie, and there was one character on the plane who used to drive people to suicide by telling his life story. So, hopefully I won't do that. So, if the starting has become like really too much, raise your hand and I'll stop. But, so I'll give you the short version. I was born in Los Angeles. So I'm a, as they say in Mexico, gringo. I was born in Los Angeles and grew up there. Went to school at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And then Acharya Prabhupada came to Berkeley and spoke there on the campus in 1969. And I was really transformed by seeing this great Vaishnava. And I started visiting the Los Angeles Temple of Hare Krishna Movement in Los Angeles during the summer, and decided I really wanted to do this, that actually Krishna really is Swayam Bhagavan. And that I thought, well, if I'm going to have integrity and really do what I know is right, then I think I have to do this. So then I moved into the Berkeley Temple, and then I did various services for Prabhupada. I took sannyas in 1972, actually, at the age of 23. Fortunately, I had no idea what I was doing. So anyway, so I took sannyas at the age of 23. Having had enough experience of the other side of life, California is kind of a fast lane for that. So then I traveled around America for 2 years, lecturing at universities all around the country. Then in 1974, Prabhupada sent me to Latin America, and we opened actually dozens of centers, Krishna centers, all over, practically in every country in Latin America, and printed and distributed millions of books. And Krishna is really famous now everywhere in Latin America. And there are many, many thousands and thousands of Krishna bhaktas all over Latin America, in every country. So then Prabhupada passed away in 1977, and somehow I took on the task of completing his translation of Sanskrit, so I kind of learned Sanskrit. And then working with other devotees, we finished translating the Bhagavatam. And then I actually felt that I wanted to get more in touch with the modern world, and somehow living in a sort of a monastic setting. I mean, it's very good for spiritual life to have that kind of sort of be culturally isolated where you just focus on your spiritual sadhana and so on. At the same time, I felt I was a little out of touch. So, also when Prabhupada passed away, I was given the responsibility of taking the duty of guru, offering diksha and so on. But in 1991, some of you were even alive then, in 1991, so we're getting back into real time now, right? Something you can relate to a little bit. So in 1991, I decided to go back to college because I had dropped out at Berkeley to take up this practice of Bhakti Yoga. So Krishna, I felt it was Krishna's desire. So I eventually completed my undergraduate degree at UCLA because I was living in LA. And then Krishna sent me to Harvard. To Harvard University in Cambridge, and it was all Krishna's arrangement, because normally you have to do a master's degree for a doctorate, but because I had so much experience translating, somehow Harvard felt that I could skip the master's program. So I just went directly into a doctorate program at Harvard, and actually did the fastest doctorate in the history of my department at Harvard. It shows you how desperate I was to get out. And, So after finishing, the doctorate was in Sanskrit and Indian studies. And then I taught for a year at Berkeley at the Graduate Theological Union, and just recently I taught at the University of Florida. Basically taught at universities around the world, and now I'm focusing more on writing. Because it's sort of the next frontier. In my life I've tried to sort of take on, how to say, sort of go to the front line of the battle, try to, you know, turn back the Kali Yuga. Good luck. And so I, you know, opening up Latin America and sort of opening up academics. So now in ISKCON, the Hare Krishna movement, there are thousands and thousands of devotees doing academic work. Before it was kind of taboo. I mean, typical, you know, sociology of new religious movements, you just stay in your own group, but... So now, for example, we have an institute at Oxford University in England. So the Hindu Studies Institute at Oxford is actually the program that we created. And many devotees are going there and getting higher degrees from Oxford and then going and teaching at universities around the world. So the idea is that we should actually teach about Krishna and teach about the Vedic culture, those who are inside it, who have the academic training but understand it at the same time. We also have another institute in Italy, near Pisa. They do programs around the university. We have another institute in Belgium. And also we have an institute for Hindu studies at the University of Florida in Gainesville. I think perhaps the next frontier to really try to establish Krishna consciousness around the world is sort of, you might say, the... I don't want to say the battlefield, I'm using too many, polemical metaphors here, but the next real challenge, I think, is cultural, and that is, by that I mean, if you take culture in this special sense of the word, things like music, or art, or theater, or literature, they really need to tackle that. If you look at the history of India, if you look at the history of India, and what you find is that India was always one of the most culturally sophisticated countries in the world. If you look in terms of everything, in terms of literature, linguistics, astronomy, architecture, philosophy, and so on. In fact, if you look at the philosophies, if you look at philosophy, the history of philosophy, there's really only two places in the world that have independently, autonomously, it's a synonym, that have independently created or come up with or somehow channeled a comprehensive, systematic philosophical tradition. There's, of course, the West, Greek philosophy and Roman and European philosophy, and India. So that if you look at even China, for example, China had wisdom traditions, such as Confucius and all that. But in terms of systematic philosophy, logic, ontology, metaphysics, epistemology, and so on. It's really just Indian Europe, so that great Indo-European civilization. So, and the intellectual and cultural power of Vedic culture, the reason that India has the oldest living culture in the world. I mean, people in, let's say, Europe or China or Polynesia or wherever, or Mississippi, I mean, they don't, you know, culture has changed. For example, Europe used to be pagan. Of course, it's going back to that now. But Europe used to be pagan, then it became Christian. But India, you have this continuously existing culture going back, really, beyond the historiographical horizon. Beyond the ability of historians to calculate, it goes past that. This continuously existing culture. So, one of the reasons this culture is so powerful is that it had this, I would say, unique ability to preserve and adapt at the same time. To somehow preserve the essence and yet adapt to changing historical circumstances. And, I mean, there's so many things we could talk about, but we have to get to Krishna because of Janmashtami, but I mean, Krishna was worshipped hundreds of years before even the appearance of Jesus. Interestingly, when the Christian missionaries first went to India, they came up with this kind of like this crazy theory to subordinate Hinduism to Christianity, that that Krishna was just a sort of an imitation of Christ until they found this column. They in Visnagar, a city in India, where they found that actually centuries before Jesus, there was a Greek ambassador to India that became a Krishna bhakta. So, anyway, that's another topic, the spread of Vedic culture, like how widespread was Vedic culture in the ancient world. The fact that they found little symbols of Pashupati Shiva in Denmark, or that they're you know, going back thousands of years, or the fact that people signed peace treaties in what is now Turkey and near the border of Europe, people signed, kingdoms signed peace treaties, you know, over 4,000 years ago in the name of Indra, Varuna, the Ashwins, and all the Vedic gods, so that actually people, we know that people are worshipping Vedic gods practically in Europe, beyond thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. So in a sense, if you may have to make one more point and then get to the point of Krishna and what we need to do today, the Renaissance, the word Renaissance means, of course, rebirth in French. It's a French word, Renaissance. And a rebirth of what? I mean, when the Renaissance occurred, what was it a rebirth of? It was actually a rebirth of Vedic culture. And I'll explain that, what I mean by that. And so I want to make the point the Hare Krishna movement is actually the culmination of the Renaissance, a process that's been going on for 500 years. If you look at ancient Europe, if you look at ancient Greece and Rome and so on, and look at the religions of ancient Greece and Rome, it is very much like what I call Mediterranean Hinduism. It's identical. You could just change some of the names, you know, maybe from Greek or Roman to Sanskrit, but it's almost this. It's really practically it is the same culture, you know, certain adaptations. It's just Mediterranean Hinduism. That was the pagan culture. The so-called pagan culture was really very, very similar to what we now know as Hinduism. And that's why practically all the European languages, all the Slavic languages, Germanic languages, Romance languages, everything except Basque and Hungarian and Finnish, actually, is very intimately connected to Sanskrit because there was an Indo-European culture. And so the Renaissance was a rebirth of that extension of Vedic culture, which was in with southern Europe around the Mediterranean. So the Krishna consciousness movement is actually trying to reestablish the full Vedic culture. It is actually the completion of the Renaissance, of this project to restore the original great civilization of this world, which was Vedic culture. And so, I mean, if we say, for example, I'm a Hindu, or I'm a Christian, or I'm a Jew, or I'm a Muslim, it's really missing the whole point of spirituality, because if you know Bhagavad Gita, the very first point that Krishna makes to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita is that you are not the body. That the body is not the real person. The body, Krishna says, vasamsi jirnani jata vihaya, just as one gives up old clothes. Navani granati parani dehi, and the embodied soul takes new garments. Tata sharirani jirnani vihaya, so giving up old bodies. Navani granati naroparani, one takes new bodies. So that's the very first lesson. So the soul, there's no such thing as a Hindu soul or a Christian soul or a Jewish soul. People sometimes think that way. But actually, souls are just eternal souls. And they're really part of God. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Mamai Vamsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, that the Sanatan Jiva, the eternal living being, is actually Ansha. Do you still have that word in Hindi, Ansha? Going.
Yes.
Yeah, you got it. So, yes, a part. So Krishna says, Mama Eva, of me alone, Mama Eva, Ansha, Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhuta, the living being, is only part of me. Now we think that I'm part of, for example, this school, or I'm part of this family, I'm part of this country, I'm part of this planet, or I'm part of this galaxy, or, you know, whatever, or I'm part of the chess club. But actually, Krishna says that ultimately we are part of God. We are really part of God. That's our real identity. That is the Sanatana Dharma. You know the word Dharma. So just like if you look at the Vedic literature, Mahabharata, Bhagavatam, or any of the... You find that, for example, there's Raja Dharma, the duties for leaders of government, or king's duties. There's Stri Dharma, woman's duties, or men's duties, or Vaishya Dharma, or and so on. There's all these duties according to Varna and Ashram, according to what your occupation is, according to what your marital situation is. But ultimately, there's Sanatana Dharma, which means it's not a duty which comes from your body type. I mean, obviously, to have a female body is a body type, or a male body, or an intellectual body, or an artistic body, or a scientific body, or whatever, or my body belongs to this clan, this jati, or that family, or whatever. And so there are temporary dharmas which come from our body type. But Sanatana Dharma doesn't come from your body type, it's you, the soul. So the Sanatana Dharma is the duty of you as an eternal soul, not as a member of this country or that community, not as a man or a woman, but your duty as an eternal soul. That is Sanatana Dharma, obviously. So, ultimately, what is that Sanatana Dharma? Krishna explains at the end of the Gita, where he says, Sarva Dharman Parityaja, putting aside all dharmas, Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, go to me alone for shelter. So, to give yourself to God is Sanatana Dharma. That's actually the Sanatana Dharma. And to give yourself to God doesn't mean you drop out of school, you reject your family, you give away all your money, and that's... No, the whole point of Bhagavad Gita was to explain to Arjuna, that's not what I mean. In fact, Krishna says to Arjuna in the Gita, what's that verse that, in the third chapter, Jayasi chet karmanas te matavudhir janardana tat king karmani ghode mang niyojya sikeshava. Arjuna thought he was, had a really knockout argument here. Arjuna said to Krishna that, Krishna, you are saying that better than just working in the world is buddhi, spiritual consciousness. Therefore, if buddhi is better than karma, why are you engaging me in this horrible karma of fighting in the war? So Arjuna thought that, this is really a good argument. And then Krishna told him, you didn't get it. You didn't get it. Because the whole point of Bhagavad Gita is that for Arjuna to give himself to Krishna, to surrender to Krishna, does not mean to give up his family and his duty. That was the whole point, right? Arjuna said, okay, I think I'm out of here, Krishna. I'm leaving this battle. I'll email you later. Maybe we'll Skype. So Arjuna wanted to leave, and the whole point of the Gita was, no, you're not going anywhere. Because that's not real tyaga, that's not real sannyas. It doesn't mean to give up your duty or your family or anything. It means you do everything for me with bhakti. And so, in fact, Krishna says in the Gita, chapter 9, yet karoshi, whatever you do. That's it. Anyway, just I can't help it. Having a little linguistic attack here. The karoshi means you do in Sanskrit. Karomi, I do. Karoshi, you do. Karoti, he or she does. And of course, this is in the Sanskrit root kri, which we still have in English in words like create. The kri and create is actually just Sanskrit, like krita. Anyway, so back to the program. So, jat karoshi, Krishna says, whatever you do, jat ashnasi, whatever you eat, yad juhoshi, whatever sacrifice you offer, dadasi yat, whatever charity you give. The Sanskrit danam, which we still have in English in the form donation. So dadasi yat, jat tapasyasi konteya, whatever austerity you perform. Just like for example, to get a higher degree is an austerity. You can't just go out and party all day every day and get a higher degree. Or anything except end up in jail, like I get Lindsay Lohan or something. But so in this world, if you really want to accomplish something, if you really want to accomplish anything, if you don't want to be a complete loser, you have to perform some austerity. You have to have discipline. You have to sacrifice, let's say, frivolous and trivial. Anyway, you heard it first, that English word. So we have to put aside all kinds of trivial pursuits if you want to get ahead in anything, in a career. If you want to have a family, if you marry, if you have children, it means these are very grave responsibilities. You can't just say one day, yeah, I'm tired of working. No, you have a child. There's no question you're tired of working. And so, tapas. Everyone has to do tapas. Everyone has to perform. The world is made in such a way that you cannot achieve excellence in anything unless you perform austerity. So, Krishna says, yet tapasyasi konteya. Whatever austerity you perform, tat kurusha. In every case, do that. Tat kurusha. Mararpanam. As an offering to me, arpan, you know this word. So whatever you do, you have to do it for Krishna. For example, let's say, well, not let's say, here's a practical example. You're here in school, and so you take a class, and you have a teacher, and the teacher, you know, Guruji, tells you that, okay, you have to write this paper, you have to read this book, you have to take whatever. So, superficially, you are now trying to please that teacher. But actually, you're trying to please your family. The real fact is that there are people in the world that you love very much, and they expect certain things of you, and you don't want to disappoint them, and you want to have a good life. And so again, superficially, okay, I'm trying to please this teacher, but actually, there are other people in my life that I'm really trying to please, the people that I really love. And someday, let's say if I get married, or I am married, and then you have a spouse that you love, and so you have to do your part to keep up, you know, a good life for your family. And even if you don't have children, you may think, someday I'll have children, I'm certainly going to love my children, and I have to provide them a good life. So if you think of what your real goals are, so in the same way, if someone is actually, to use Sanskrit, you probably understand this, shuddhatma, a pure soul, then, yes, we have duties, we do all those duties like Arjuna, but ultimately, I'm trying to please Krishna. Because ultimately, Krishna's in my heart. Krishna says, that sarvasya chaham hridisam nirishta, I'm situated in everyone's heart. So why does a mother and father love their child? It's not automatic. I mean, if we want to get into some of the more grotesque forms of zoology, you can find parents that eat their children. I guess until they burp and then they let some of the kids live so the species doesn't go extinct. So what we can see by looking at other forms of life is that it's not, quote-unquote, automatic that you love your children. Why does a mother or father love their child? Because Krishna loves them. And Krishna is inspiring in the heart of the mother and the heart of the mother, of the father, the love that Krishna feels. Because Krishna says in the Gita, Pitaham asya jagato, I'm the father of this world. And then he says, Mata. This is not male chauvinism. Krishna says, Pitaham asya jagato, Mata, and the mother. So the love that a mother feels or a father feels, it's actually first felt by Krishna. It's Krishna that loves your child first. And then Krishna, in your heart, inspires you to love your child. And the love you feel for your parents, it's actually Krishna in your heart inspiring you, love these people. Because by loving a mother and father, it's a step in God realization. Because ultimately the Paramapita, or the Paramamata, the Supreme Father and Mother, is God. And so by loving, I mean, there are very, let's say, degraded people that don't even love their parents. Or may turn against their parents. So at least if one is civilized enough to love one's own parents, then it's a step toward discovering the Supreme Parent. Radha Krishna, Sita Ram, Lakshmi Narayan. So in that way, Krishna, just like Krishna talks to Arjuna, he's really speaking to all of us. Don't leave your battlefield, whether your battlefield is to get your higher degree, or to somehow or other make a family work, or to, you know, whatever your struggle is, whatever your goals are, we have to follow Arjuna and do whatever we're doing for Krishna. So Krishna appeared in this world. Krishna's, I mean, the way they say it traditionally in India was the Avirbhav Mahotsav Tithi. I don't know if you understand that language. Avirbhav, appearance, Mahotsav, festival, Tithi, which technically means a lunar day. They used to use a lunar calendar in India. So, why did Krishna come? Leave you in suspense. It's a cliffhanger. So, Krishna explains why he came to this world. He says, you know, everyone in India knows this verse or should know. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam sujamyaham paritranaya sadhunam, to save the good guys. Vinashaya cha dushkatam, to wipe out the bad guys. Dharma sansthapanarthaya, and to reestablish dharma. The actual, for example, they recently had riots in London. And unless you're like a violent anarchist, you know, you understand that was not a good thing. And so they had to reestablish dharma, because the word dharma means law. It's just like when literally all hell breaks loose and there's a collapse of civilization. That's a bad thing. And so Krishna, I mean, the good news is that the universe is created with a service contract. You know, it's like you buy some appliance or some computer, and you buy the service contract, so if it doesn't work, they come and fix it for you. So Krishna is so kind, he creates the universe with a service contract. So he says that, therefore, when the machine is kind of getting all messed up, he comes and fixes it. And reestablishes dharma. So Krishna is so kind that he allows us to join him, to help him. Just like when Ramchandra came, he gave so much service to Hanumanji or to Lakshman, to other great bhaktas. So Krishna could save the world himself, but he allows us to also participate. And so whatever we do, I mean, it doesn't matter, whatever your career path, I'm sure no one here plans to become a butcher or or something like that. So any decent occupation, that can become your seva. That becomes with devotion to Krishna. So, Nitika is a great example. I mean, she got her degrees from a prestigious university. She's now teaching. She's on her way in her career. And yet she is very much devoted to Krishna. She loves Krishna. And within the situation she finds herself in, she's doing everything she can to follow the example of Arjuna or Hanumanji. So, and her husband, of course, that you do all, is also doing great service. We are gender blind. So, so the real challenge to us now, as I see it, the historical challenge, if you were, so to speak, like the anthropologist or the sociologist from, Jupiter or something, you came down to this Earth, and we're just sort of looking at this Earth objectively. The real challenge now is to somehow take this Vedic culture and preserve its essence and yet adapt it again. Because it's not just Indian culture. The word Indian, of course, as you know, is a European word. By the way, Jupiter is Sanskrit. Didn't know that? In Sanskrit, you know the word Divya, right? Divya and Deva and all those words. Words like Divya and Deva in Sanskrit come from a root which is Dyu, or Dyau. And so Dyu actually means heaven. And Pitar, you know, Pita. Pitar is a stem form of the Sanskrit word Pita. So Dyu Pitar literally means Father of Heaven. Anyway, so you know where the word India comes from, don't you? In ancient times, there still is a great river that runs now through Pakistan. Yeah, the Indus. Anyway, talking about wonderful failed states. So there's this river, Indus River, which in Sanskrit is called the Sindhu. You know the word Sindhu. So the people that lived west of the river had a particular speech pattern where they pronounced an initial S, an S at the beginning of a word as an H. So they pronounce Sindhu Hindu. Actually, you see this also, for example, there's a Sanskrit word Sama, which means same, equal. And so the same thing, you change the S to H, it becomes the well-known prefix homo. It's a homogeneous. Sama Jatiya, homogeneous. Anyway, so the people on the west side of the river, the people on the west side said Hindu, and then next to the Persian civilization was the Greek civilization, and they don't pronounce an H at the beginning of a word, like the English word honor. So Hindu became Indu, and Indus, and then India. But anyway, the real Bharatiya Dharma, or civilization, is not just a national thing. It's actually meant for the whole world. Because Krishna says, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, Sarva Loka Maheshwar. Just like now, there's all this controversy. Very interesting about, they want a Lokpal. I personally find this very promising. People are waking up. Oh my God, they're stealing everything. So anyway, you understand this. So Krishna ultimately, he's the supreme Lokpal, you could say. Krishna says, Sarva Loka Maheshwara. And so Krishna doesn't just say Bharata Lok or Angreji Lok. Krishna is actually Sarva Lok Maheshwaram. So the real challenge is to find a way to present this knowledge of Krishna in a way that the world can understand it and to revive this great civilization. Doesn't mean going backwards. Doesn't mean we have to give up our computers or anything. It just means using everything for Krishna, understanding who we really are. As you know, nowadays, there's basically, we'll know we're making progress when Lady Gaga is replaced by Lady Ganga. as you know, even coming from India, the world is becoming so crude and gross and crass. It's like, I remember there was a nice devotee, a lady she was very funny, she used to say, it's like school in the summertime, no class. So, no class. It's just, and that's the nature of culture nowadays. It's become so pashu dharma. It's become so bestial. And everything is about sexuality. Everything is about the body. The body is everything nowadays. And so this knowledge that we are actually atma, that we're actually soul, is almost been lost. So, anyway, I won't go on forever. In case you were afraid that might actually happen. So we encourage you. I'll end just with one little... The lecture's not that good. Another satisfied customer.
Thank you.
There's a nice verse spoken by Lord Chaitanya, whom we accept as Krishna, coming down for the Kali Yuga. And it's in Bengali, but it's sort of Sanskrit Bengali, so you may understand it. The verse is, Bharata bhumi te hoila manusha janmajar. So one was taken manusha janma in Bharata bhumi. One was taken a human birth in Bharata bhumi. Bharata bhumi te... What is that? Janma sartha kori. One should fulfill the purpose of one's life, which is ultimately spiritual, and then kara paropakar, and then actually help people. I know in India they had this slogan, maybe they still have it. What was it? Madhav seva.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it sounds like kind of catchy and everything, but if you put it under scrutiny, if we really scrutinize that, it's just like, let's say, for example, you decide that you want to be a doctor, and therefore you want to help people. I mean, you have to actually get trained. You can't just go out on the street untrained and say, I love people, I want to help people. Okay, here's a wounded person, well, let me take a look at that. And you're not trained, you have no idea what you're doing, never even taken a course in anatomy. It's just like, well, never mind all that, you know, it's really all in the heart. And that's a new modern philosophy. Although God gave us a brain and a heart, we can sort of, look, you know, we can lobotomize ourselves and just go with the heart. It's just all the heart. Like you don't need a brain. But actually, having a brain and a heart is a very good combination. So, just like if you want to help people medically, you need some training. So that's very nice. Manav Seva. It's a great idea. But unless we really know who is the manav, who is that person? If we think the person is merely the body, we don't even know who the manav is. So how can we really help that person? So if, like, for example, when you go to a hospital, you know, there's, let's say that they have like palliative care, there's the nurse and they maybe try to make you comfortable, like go in there and you're in pain, okay, here's something to ease the pain, you're bleeding, okay, we'll stop the bleeding. But ultimately, you need to see a doctor. You need to find out what's really wrong with you. You can't just, you know, pop a few pills in the hospital so you don't feel anything. I feel good now. You know, maybe you're actually dying. You're injured. You have some terminal illness that perhaps can be stopped. But no, they don't treat your real disease. They just, you know, make you feel very happy by giving you some drugs. So in the same way, sure, of course we have to take care of people's bodies. Of course we have to feed the hungry. We have to provide shelter for people. I mean, of course, any civilized country has to provide, you know, basic amenities and comforts to everyone. Of course. But then when do we get to the real problem? The real problem is, what are you even doing here in this material world? What are you doing here? If you're an eternal soul, why are you even here? Why do you take birth here? And you can give everyone, you know, first-class medical treatment, food, shelter, everything, and they die anyway. So let's get to the real issue. Why are we in this world? Why do we have to die? Krishna says, janma mrityu jara vyadi dukkha dosha nudarshana. Keep your eye focused on the fact of birth, death, old age, and disease. There's no problem that's going to fix that. So it's interesting because biotechnology, you know, the problem is, yes, we will fix that. But sort of like the Frankenstein approach. But I mean, I am a big fan of biotechnology, I should say. I found it profoundly moving that, you know, let's say it's almost like biotechnology is the new Jesus. You know, the blind can see and the lame can walk. And so it is inspiring. I think it's a wonderful thing. I mean, no, none of us want people to suffer. And so I think biotechnology is, I think it's a gift of God. At the same time, we should have reasonable expectations and understand that we are in the material world and ultimately there's certain things which can only be achieved spiritually. So have a balanced life, right? Balance. Do your career, whatever it is, do it well, become a leader in your field, have a great life, and at the same time, save your soul. You need to do both. So, thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Any questions? They're too smart to ask questions. They know that'll delay the food. It's a smart group. Okay, no questions? You can ask anything. Nothing's too shocking.
Mark?
Yes.
Just one point about that love, Krishna in our heart.
Yes.
So how do we explain hate? Like someone hating someone else?
Yes, Krishna talked about that in the Gita, raga dvesha. Raga, I'm attached to someone, rati, and then dvesha. You have that word, don't you, Saul, in India? Dvesha? Hatred. So, hatred is actually the asura bhav. It's actually a demonic quality. When we forget God, we become envious. Envious of God, envious of other people, and so that love becomes corrupted. Becomes transformed into hatred. So what are we going to do now, Professor?
He had a question.
Yes.
I thought you said you had a question. Yeah. Does anyone have a question? Feel free to ask.
Free, yeah. I mean, after 8:30, we start charging. But until 8:30, it's free to ask.
Anu, do you have a question?
No, I think they're so satisfied with them. They have no questions. They agree with everything, so I think it's okay.
We're just going to have Aarti now.
Please.
Would you like to offer the Aarti Maharaj?
I hear about something. Would you like to do it?
And then what will you do?
What do you do?
I'll do it. Whatever you'd like to do, kind of just be part of it.
Whatever, and then in...
Yes, Maharaj.
Are we going to chant?
Yes, Maharaj. Would you like to chant?
Sachi wants to chant?
It's up to you if you would like
Sachi. To chant. Where's Sachi?
I just went to open the garage door.
Oh. It is a big advantage to take birth in a good family in India, because you get so much culture just growing up. It's a big advantage.
I have a question.
Yes.
So, you said that the motherly love and everything comes from Krishna, and it was not there before. Like in small creatures, they kill their child.
Oh right.
And so, right.
Some of them.
Yeah, some of them. But what I have heard is. They don't kill, but they kill only those which are not capable of doing anything by themselves, because they might be ill or they might be
sick. Right. So I think it depends on the species. Because, yes, for example, there are some species where the father kills the child out of sort of type of rivalry.
Yeah, it's for its own. Fatherly love is actually imposed on.
Yeah.
But the motherly love, I think, it continues from the. Creatures, which have developed brain, probably.
Yeah, yeah. If we look at the whole range of species, we'll find all kinds of different behaviors at different levels and so on.
So if you take in that way, this is not that Krishna is for humans and he's not for the creatures lower than him.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point. That actually Krishna says, Sarva Yonishu Kunteya Murti, that I'm the... Actually, that verse where he says, Sarva Yonishu Kunteya, in all yonis, in all species. Sarva Yonishu Kunteya Murtaya, the murtis, the different forms. Murtaya Sambhavanti Ja, Tasam, of all these different species. Aham, Tasam Brahma Mahajoni, of all these, the Brahma, or the material creation, is the yoni, the womb. And aham, Bija Pradakpita, I am the seed-giving father. So yes, Krishna claims to actually be the father of all species. It's a good point. And that's why there's a very interesting book about India. The best picture we have of India, let's say about 2,300 years ago, is a book written by a Greek ambassador named Megasthenes. He wrote a book called Indica about India. He was an ambassador to the Maurya Empire in Pataliputra. So he describes India over 2,000 years ago, and it's obviously the most civilized country in the world. He said it's the only country that doesn't have slavery. it's a country where all the arts are subsidized by the government, where the government, their animal rights, and there are hospitals for animals. This is almost 2,500 years ago in India. They had animal hospitals. And that, I mean, it's an amazing description of a very, very advanced country. He also says that unlike other countries in warfare, no one will ever attack a non-combatant. They have a much higher ethical code for warfare. And he goes on and on. He really describes it as practically the most advanced country in the world. And, of course, then there have been various invasions. I think it's very interesting what's happening now in India, because if you look at the history going back thousands of years, whenever India was not being oppressed by some foreign rule, it actually was extremely advanced, highly moral civilization. And so in historical time, now it's only been 64 years, right, since the independence. I can still do math at my age. That hasn't gone yet. So now it's only six, which in historical time is a very, very short time. So this whole thing now, you know, this whole, you know what's going on in India now, all the news and everything, is very promising, because in a sense, what I hope is happening is that India is kind of like bouncing back. Because if you look at India before the Muslim invasion, anyway, won't go into that. If you, and then, of course, you know, the Muslims sort of involuntarily passed the baton to the British. And so if you look at, hopefully what is happening now is that after approximately, not quite 1,000 years, really of a lot of India being under foreign rule, maybe like 800 years, 850 years, and so it's, again, they have Swaraj, again, they have their sovereignty. And so hopefully what's happening is it's going to do what India always did in the past when they had the freedom to do it, which is it became, you know, extremely advanced country. Okay. In education, I mean the first universities, there were universities in India, Nalanda, and they were before the great universities in Europe. So India was an extreme Aryabhatta. If you know in trigonometry, sine, cosine, all that, that's actually from Sanskrit. That, you know, that's Aryabhatta. So that's what I hope is happening. I hope India is just bouncing back and will again become the glorious civilization that it's always has been when it was independent. So I think, you know, as we know, the corruption is just like, I mean, it's total. You know, it's absolute. And so hopefully that's what's happening now.
Let it reach the peak.
What was that?
Let it reach the peak and then come down.
Well, it's nice that the people, because there are so many good, intelligent people in India, that it's nice they're finally, you know, kind of, feeling their moxie. Yes.
With the younger generation, like I have two boys and the young people here, there's such a drastic change. It's almost like deja vu. Like we lived here 18 years from 1980 to 97, end of 97. And now in India for the last 13, 14 years, it's like what we saw was happening in the West is exact replica. It seems like, oh, you know, they're following the West, and seems the West is following, you know, more towards the East, yoga and meditation and things like that. But it's a drastic change.
In India?
Yeah, in India.
Yes, the blue jean yoga. It's, you know,
it's shocking, actually.
Well, it's shocking, but I sort of have mixed feelings about that, about India today, because, I mean, thinking now like a historian, if you know, like, the theory of history of philosophers like Hegel and even Marx, that history moves dialectically. You know, there's the thesis, then the antithesis, and the synthesis. Sin, by the way, is also Sanskrit. The S-Y-N, it means together, and that Sanskrit sum, like Sankirtan or some yoga. But anyway, so if history actually moves dialectically like that, then if you look at, let's say, because I first went to India in 1974, and it was very different back then. And you could say in some ways it was, you know, 1,000 times more peaceful and so on. But so you could wish that, let's say that India would have gone from what it was maybe back then, like post-World War II or whatever, sort of, you know, very pious and very simple and not so materialistic and everything. I mean, just think, you know, think your grandparents. So, if it could have gone from that to, let's say, a big revival of Vedic culture. And of course, but I suspect, as much as even Prabhupada wanted that, I suspect that maybe history just doesn't move that way. Because in a sense, if you look at India, say back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s even, early 70s, let's say, when people were, you know, it was just not at all a sensuous culture. People were very disciplined and austere and so on. But they had many misconceptions also. But so it's almost like, I suspect that historically, India almost has to go through a period of not giving up their culture, but kind of, like the young people nowadays, becoming free of certain, like, let's say, like, obsessions with caste. Because it was obsessive. It was almost like a psychological disorder. I mean, you know, like this obsession with the body, with jati. It's obsessive and clannish. And actually, people, like, the public can go to hell, you know, all I care about is my people. And so it's a real symptom of third world civilizations where you really don't care about the public. You know, the public? Who cares about the public? All I care about is my family, my clan. And of course, which leads to massive corruption. Because of course you're not honest. Of course you cheat for your family. Of course you get everything for your family because that's all I care about. So there were all kinds of, you could say, sociological features in the old civilization, or, for example, certain misconceptions about Vedic culture. Thinking, for example, that in Vedic culture, that Vedic culture, or the ultimate truth, is polytheistic, or it doesn't matter what you think God is, nothing matters, you know, because every path is the same as every other path, which has nothing to do with Indian history. I mean, that's a very modern thing. That was manufactured about 150 years ago. Or less, 120 years ago. I mean, even the fact of people in India calling themselves Hindu. I published a paper, actually, with an Oxford publication on the history of the word Hindu in India. The history of the use of the word Hindu in India. And you can identify basically three historical stages. In the earliest stage, which you can just call Vedic culture, they don't use the word Hindu. Because people know how to pronounce the word properly. It's Sindhu. And no one's going to call you. They don't say, like, what are you? I'm an ocean. Or I'm a big river. I mean, you know, that would be absurd. So obviously no one called themselves a Sindhu. Except maybe some, you know, crazy people. But so then you have the Muslim invasion, you know, which was horrific in many ways. You have this Muslim invasion. And, I mean, when you actually read the details of history, it's worse than you think. But anyway, so you have this invasion, and then the people from the west side, northwest side, they come into India with their mispronunciation. And so if you look at India, and this is judging from literature, like Chaitanya Charitamrita, I mean, if you look at literature written by quote-unquote Hindus in India, let's say about 500 years ago or 450 years ago, they only use the word Hindu when they're talking to Muslims. Because none of the Sanatan Dharmis, or whatever you want to call them, they didn't call themselves Hindu. It was the Muslims that, in fact, the Muslims called everyone that wasn't a Muslim a Hindu. So the Buddhists were Hindus, the Jains were Hindus, everyone was a Hindu. And then gradually it became focused on what we now call the Hindus. So, but if you look at Indian literature written by quote-unquote Hindus in India back at that time, a Shaiva, a Vaishnava, in other words, what we now call Hindu, they would never call themselves Hindu. They never called themselves that. They only use the word when they're speaking to Muslims. And usually, it's the Muslim calling the other person a Hindu. But then what happened? What happened is, I'll just give a very short version of this. how the word Hindu actually became. How did the word Hindu, how did people in India start calling themselves Hindu instead of just having Muslims call them that? So this is, very briefly the history. What happened is that when the English took over India, something new and more dangerous happened. Because when the Muslims ruled India, for all their atrocities and for all the crazy things they did, I mean, there were some, brighter moments like Akbar and so on. But for all the bad things they did, they had nothing culturally or religiously which impressed anyone that much. I mean, they had some things like, they have some sort of nifty architecture, or maybe they brought some musical instruments, little things in that. But in terms of general civilization, everyone was kind of underwhelmed on the Indian side. So that if you look at all this very sophisticated, let's say, Vedic literature, which is very intellectually sophisticated, and then look at the Quran, it's like, I don't think so. And so what happened is, I mean, just the history, is that the lowest class people, for material inducements, tend to be converted. Like if you become a Muslim, you'll get this and you'll get that. And so the higher caste people, they have absolutely no interest in that kind of thing. So, but if you look at the English takeover of India, and of course the English, they came there saying, no, we just want to do business, we're just here to do business. And then, of course, they saw an opportunity. And so, because the Mughal Empire was fading, and so they just kind of filled the void. But look at England, look at Europe, let's say around 200 years ago. If you look at Europe 200 years ago, it is absolutely on top of the world. They have all these new technologies, the Industrial Revolution, which really blew everyone's mind. I mean, think of it. If you're living in a world where there are no real machines, just like little things like you can weave or something, and suddenly railroads and telegraph, just all these things, all this new technology, printing press, and the great European universities, the rational method. Because Europe came into India riding the wave of rationalism, Newton, sort of deciphering the universe. All this new science and rationality and logic and all these new ideas. So the European intellectual juggernaut and the new technologies and all these things, the scientific method, really impressed intelligent Indians. So this is very different. I mean, some things from the Muslim period, maybe were impressive. But modernity, it was Europe, it was really the modern world was just unfolding. And many intelligent Indians thought, this is really cool. Science is cool, and technology, and the rational method. And it's a fact, we don't see the gods, like, where are they anyway? So let's go with science. And so you had this problem. This problem occurred in India, and that is, unlike under the previous regime, you had some of the brightest young minds in India, really intelligent people. What they call in West Bengal, because the English capital, of course, is in Calcutta, and so the young intellectuals, the really sharp, best young people, they formed these groups. They were called Bhadralok. I don't know if they still use that term in India, but they were called the Bhadralok. And so Europe, the West, modernity started seducing all these Indians, like, oh my God, like the modern world. So then came the pushback, because obviously there were a lot of people in India who thought this is not a good thing, we're becoming corrupted, we are selling out to modernity, so then you start getting the pushback. And the pushback took forms like the Arya Samaj and the Brahmo Samaj and these different groups that started to reassert the superiority of Vedic culture. And although often they didn't understand it. Or they were reasserting what they believed was Vedic culture. And then, so all this is going on. There's a real culture war going on. And you can read it. There's a real culture war going on between the modern world. So the modern world is picking up steam. It's not wilting. It's actually getting stronger and stronger. Newer and newer technologies. It's just getting more and more impressive all the time. And then you have traditional people in India fighting back, trying to defend their traditional culture. And then there's a watershed event, which is that Vivekananda comes to the Congress of Religions in Chicago, and sort of he plays this. I mean, he was a very intelligent person, although, and I don't want to disappoint anybody, but the actual history is he knew very little about Vedic literature. He probably didn't really read it that much. And if you look at how he talks about Vedic culture, it's obvious from a scholarly point of view, he has very little idea of what it actually is. But what he did was he sort of played this card of one-upsmanship, like where he said that Hinduism is not merely... Hare Krishna. Come on in. So Vivekananda presented, let's say, Vedic or Indian religion as not only tolerable, or maybe it's also religion, not just Christianity, but actually superior. Whereas he said Christianity is guilt-ridden. In Vedic culture, it's not this like guilty thing, your sins, your sins, your sins. Christianity is intolerant. Hinduism is tolerant. And so the great revolution or the great breakthrough of Vivekananda was to actually show that the spirituality from India is not merely something maybe to be tolerated, but actually it's even in some ways even superior. And this is at a time when other people like Thoreau from Walden Pond, Thoreau was reading Bhagavad Gita, Emerson, all these great Schopenhauer in Europe, all these great Western intellectuals who were fed up with Christian fanaticism, had turned to India as like the antidote. Like, here's an alternative monotheism. Now, it's interesting because... so anyway, getting to the point, why Hindus call themselves Hindu. Because for those who just came in, I explained that this is a very modern thing, because even, let's say, 200 or 300 years ago, no one in India called himself a Hindu. It was what the Muslims called the Indians. What happened is that people like Vivekananda and Dr. Radhakrishnan, later, actually came up with a conscious strategy, and this is documented in their lectures. It wasn't clandestine, it wasn't secret. They spoke about it openly, they wrote about it, so we know exactly what they did. And their strategy was that, in a sense, the power, you know, why are Christianity and Islam so powerful? They spread around the world, and you know, we're kind of under siege here, Hindu. Why are they so powerful? They're powerful because they're like one sectarian religion. Like, we're Christians or we're Muslims. So therefore, they said, what we need to do in India is we need to put forward the idea that we're all really just one religion. We need to put forward the idea that we're one religion. Now, if you look at the actual history of India for thousands of years, what you find is, in fact, there were different traditions, such as the followers of Shiva or Vishnu or Shakti, or the Tantrikas, or the Yogis, there were actually different, but because they didn't kill each other, no one thought they were different religions. And you think about it, to be a Muslim, you have to accept the Old Testament and the New Testament. But because they were always killing each other, they had this barbarian tribal concept of religion, in which, you know, my God can beat up your God. But in India, they actually had different traditions with different points of view. But because it was a more advanced civilization, there was tolerance, there was mutual respect. But there were different traditions. And so Vivekananda came along and said, never mind all that. You know, we can't afford to have different traditions now because we've got to fight back against this, you know, Christian missionaries and all this stuff. And so therefore, let's just say we're one religion, let's call it Hinduism. And of course, this started before Vivekananda. This sort of like where people in India started internalizing a name that foreigners, even their enemies, called them, and they never called themselves. They began to use this word. And so therefore, Vivekananda also, and this is kind of like, I hate to say it because he's sort of a hero, but kind of like the sinister part of his strategy. And that is, he decided that in order to unite what we should now call Hindus, we need to do away with specificity. In other words, if someone is a Krishna Bhakta or someone is a, you know, a Shiva Bhakta or this and that, then there's room for, you know, disagreement. So therefore, let's do away with all that. In other words, let's basically trash the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's what it amounts to. I remember that I spoke at a Hindu temple in, what was it? So many places I've spoken. So this was in Knoxville, Tennessee, by the University of Tennessee. And in the back of the temple, they had this big poster, like you know, what it means to be Hindu. And so it was like it had pictures on it and everything. And basically what it taught is that there are different, say, avatars or manifestations of God, like Krishna or this or that or Shiva. But ultimately, the Parameshwar, ultimately the Supreme God is something else. It's this nameless, formless thing that can never cause anyone to disagree with anybody else because there's no specific information about it. It's just God, which is strikingly resembles the Christian God, which is not a coincidence. It's just like the Arya Samaj. They opposed the Puranas. They said, no, forget the deities in the temple. Why? Because the Christians objected to it. They thought it was idol worship. So it's very interesting. You get this. You can definitely see this historical synthesis where certain people in India, in order to compete with Christianity, save India from the missionaries and make you know the Vedic culture respectable in the modern world, they sort of put aside certain aspects which are at the center of Vedic culture, but which Christians weren't comfortable with. So you end up with a Hindu god who bears a striking resemblance to the Christian god or the Muslim god. I mean, she's very clearly in a Sikh religion, where they kind of, in order to try to, you know, merge things together, although they were really Krishna Bhaktas, sort of like in the closet, but they... And so the Sikh movement was another movement that tried to historically deal with this problem by sort of ejecting really what is at the heart of the Vedic culture, but thinking that it kind of, you know, it gets in the way of integration. So what Prabhupada did when he came to the West was to say, wait a second, the truth is the truth. And if you look at Bhagavad Gita, Krishna very clearly says, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava, I'm the source of everything. Krishna never says that I'm an avatar of someone else. He says everyone else is an avatar of me. So, I mean, I've given so many lectures to Hindu audiences where someone will say, but in the Bhagavad Gita it says, and it's not there. Basically, anyone who has any idea, they just think it's in the Bhagavad Gita. But if you actually read the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is giving a different story. And to say that in order to teach the world, in order to establish the real glory of the Vedic culture, we have to kind of hide it, or we have to pretend it's something else, is not really true. That's, to be honest, it's almost effeminate. In the sense that if you look at the Vedic culture, if you look at the Pandavas, if you look at Ramchandra, Arjuna, Hanumanji, these were not weak people. There was a time, if you look at Indian history, there was a time in Vedic culture when it was a very self-confident, powerful civilization that actually brought its knowledge around the world. It didn't try to pretend it was something else because someone may not like it. And what we find is, and it's not sectarian, the history of India is that they could disagree on these things without fighting wars over it because they were sophisticated, they were cosmopolitan. The Rig Veda, it's the oldest, it's probably the oldest book in the world, the Rig Veda, and it's cosmopolitan. It says, there's, you know, that famous verse that Ekam San Bahudha, Rishayo Vedanti, that there's one truth, but people describe it in different ways. So the understanding that the one God may appear differently to different people, religious tolerance, freedom, it goes back to the earliest Vedic civilization. There was freedom of speech in Vedic civilization. If you read Mahabharata, this is amazing. This is unimaginable in any other part of the world. In the Mahabharata, when people thought that the Kuru, Dhritarashtra, and Duryodhana had killed the Pandavas by burning the house down, when people thought that was the case, they went into the middle of the city and just insulted the king. And there was not even a hint that it was illegal to do that, or that there was any reprisal or punishment for that. People had complete freedom of that. People had freedom of speech. They had freedom of religion. This is thousands and thousands of years ago. This was a very advanced civilization, which practically led the world in many ways. And so we're trying to bring back this original knowledge, not just some hybrid concoction, you know, pulling something here, pulling something there, and just you know, trying to manufacture something and calling it a religion. We're trying to go back to the original culture, because that's what the world needs. At the same time, adapt it, present it in an acceptable, modern, intelligent, reasonable way, but without mutilating it. So the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna very clearly says, it's me, it's me, you know, it's Krishna. Krishna's not a manifestation of something else. He's not an incarnation of something else. He doesn't represent something else. That is nowhere in the Gita. Krishna clearly says, I am the source of everything. So, anyway, thank you for your patience in listening to this. But so, that's the real glory of India. The real glory of India is to bring back into the world this great knowledge, this wisdom, because the world needs it. Unless there's a spiritual revolution or renaissance in the world, this planet is, it doesn't look that good. We can kind of like, you know, we can kind of like feed off the dying body. It's like even when a body has a terminal illness, there are all kinds of parasites in the body that are still feeding very happily. And so as this planet kind of, you know, as civilization crumbles before our eyes, we can just kind of like, you know, be like parasites and try to feed off it while it's crumbling and at least, you know, get our place in the sun for a little while. But actually, what we should do is really be more responsible. Sure, pursue your career, become a great success in whatever you choose, but at the same time, take part in this effort to save the planet. It's like a summer blockbuster movie. You know, trying to help Krishna to save the world. So, thank you very much. I guess we'll do the arching now. Actually, people in India don't have so much attention. What do they call it?
Deficit disorder.
Yeah, you actually have a little more. I mean, still in India, it's a little more civilized. In America, everyone's like, you know, at least you can pay attention a little longer still. So,